Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Bing Predicts for Enterprise. Our presenters for today are Rani Kumsie, Senior Program Manager at Microsoft, and Walter Sun, Partner Applied Science Manager at Microsoft. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run for about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation and a recording link will be sent to you via email once the files are available. If you have any questions during the webcast, please enter your question in the Q&A widget on the left of your screen and click Submit. We'll try and get through as many questions as we can during the live broadcast. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Walter.
Thank you, Behi. Good morning, everyone. My name is Walter Sun, and Rani and I today will talk, as Behi mentioned, about our work in Bing Predicts. The idea of Bing Predicts is that we apply web and social data in an anonymized fashion to make inferences on a variety of events. Before we get started, I guess one of the things I'd like to do is to give you some context as to how this project started. Rani and I have been in Bing search for many years. I've been in Bing about eight and a half years. Rani's been about 5 years. Years ago, I guess one of the first things that I was tasked to do is to look at ranking fresh results. And one of the things that was kind of interesting was that we would be interested in finding out what's kind of recent, what's happening in the news every day. And by virtue of that, I would look at the top queries for the day. Bing had a service called XRank back in the day, which is similar to what Google Trends, most of you may be familiar with that. And to make sure the quality of our searches were good, I would keep an eye on that every day. And over the winter, around 2008, I noticed a lot of queries were coming in about school districts. And so the idea was that you'd see, you know, Hennepin County School District in Minnesota, you'd see, Boston Latin or whatever, different type of schools, and none of it kind of translated to any real news. And that was kind of surprising because usually people submit queries or searches when they want to find certain news, right? And all of it was kind of mysterious until one day we were expecting a snow event in Seattle. And I was trying to finish up and go home in the evening. And I checked before I went home and saw that Lake Washington School District, which is the local school district in Seattle, was the number one query on XRank, which is our Bing search trends tool. And thinking that maybe it's just a kind of an aberration because XRank, you know, is for Bing, I checked Google Trends. And sure enough, the number one spiking query on Google Trends is also Lake Washington School District. And the conclusion, I guess, that you can kind of get to is that, you know, there's no breaking news about it, right? But the idea is that looking at school queries or queries about school districts can correlate very highly to weather, in particular snow closures in the winter or other events in other parts of the year. And while, you know, meteorology is already a solved problem or a well-understood problem, so we wouldn't expect to kind of use Bing Predicts to solve weather forecasting. The idea was there that you can look at, you know, you can be stuck in a windowless room in a building, and you can look at web searches that people are making and infer what weather patterns are around the country. And this information is kind of a first step in terms of thinking about what can we do, right? And over the years, I tried a bunch of different things and eventually got to the point where we can incubate the project and start it publicly. And when we first started, Rani was our first product manager on the product. And we've been at the beginning looking at how we can use predictions with web, social, and other relevant data to make intelligent predictions about upcoming events. We focus on reality shows because reality shows are based off of consumer voting behavior, so we can find very high correlations there. We moved over to award shows, which is a little bit different, but still somewhat popularity related. And then elections, which is also voting by the people. And then we moved to sports, and sports is a little bit different. We'll talk about it more, but the idea of sports is that you may argue, well, sports is obviously not popularity, but there's this idea of a wisdom of the crowds, where you can actually build a statistical model for sports and then on top of that add the popular wisdom. And that popular wisdom has a lot of value to kind of what you can get. So we'll talk about the experiences that we share on Bing.com and then talk about how we have been incubating and thinking about how we can apply this to enterprise scenarios. I'll hand over to Rani to talk about the data available.
Thanks, Walter. Hey, everyone. And so nowadays the wealthiest amount of information and the biggest data set that we can look at is available online. right? Since kind of the dot-com revolution, people have been turning online for everything, whether they want to buy, whether they want to research about a topic, whether, you know, they have a migraine and they're wondering which medication to take, and whatever that thing may be, people nowadays trust their search engines and trust their friends online via social media to essentially go and research and understand what they're trying to buy or what they're trying to do. And so nowadays we have about 8 billion searches that are done every day on different search engines like Bing, Google, and Yahoo. We have about 6 billion hours of videos that are watched each month on YouTube. I mean, that's just a massive amount, right? That's years of videos that are watched each month on YouTube by different users. We have around 500 million tweets that are sent out every day, and they contain all different kind of sources of information, right? What a user is watching, or who a user is voting for, or how he feels about certain topics, what he or she has just recently bought, and all sorts of other different information. And also on Facebook, people spend about 640 billion minutes every month. And so why am I talking about all these sources of information? And the reason is because being at Microsoft, we actually have access to almost all of that data set. Being a search engine in Bing, what we do, we index the web. So every publicly available document that you can type within a browser and then see on your window, whether that's a tweet, whether that's a public Facebook page, whether that's a YouTube page, or an Amazon search results page, a Google search results page, or a Bing search results page. All of those results are actually indexed, and we have access to them offline so we can parse them, crawl them, and understand the data that's in them. At the same time, being a search engine that's available through our different operating systems, through our mobile devices, through our tablets, which is Bing, and also syndicated through other search providers such as, for example, Siri on iOS devices, we have access as well to what people search for and what they click for online. And then finally, through our browsers, which are Internet Explorer and Edge, we also have access to what people browse for online. Now, of course, all of that data to us, to Microsoft, is anonymized, and when we look at it, we look at it in an aggregate way. But the way to think about it is, you know, the data at its raw form, when you look at it from a one user's perspective. So, you know, you look at one user who searched for Xbox One, right? Now, that search by itself is meaningless. It could mean anything, right? It could mean that the user is searching for it because he's trying to learn some news about it. It could be that he's searching for it because he's doing some research on which one he wants to buy, you know, the Xbox One console or the PlayStation 4. It could be that he's searching for it because he's planning on getting it as a gift for someone, but he probably won't be purchasing it for another 3 to 4 months. It could be that he's just checking prices, or it could be that he's actually going to the, you know, Amazon website and he's trying to buy the Xbox One platform. So that, you know, single data point of him performing a search or visiting a page may mean nothing. So then there's that information layer on top of things on which you aggregate, cluster, and categorize the data. This is where we kind of anonymize and put the information in aggregate and say something along the lines, the number of people that searched for the Xbox One platform over the past month is 20,000. But again, that information by itself, even though now it gives us a little bit more information, it's still not what we're looking for, right? Again, and 20,000 people searching for information for the Xbox One could mean anything, right? It doesn't translate directly to how many people are actually buying the Xbox One platform. And so this is where our work comes in, right? We want to get to that knowledge layer, and this is where Bing Predicts comes in. We actually utilize innovative, state-of-the-art machine learning algorithms that have been developed over the past 8 years, and they are the ones that power Bing.com search results and make it the search engine that it is today. We utilize these machine learning algorithms on top of the data that we have today in order to predict the future. So essentially, if we were to take that information that we have access to, what people search for around Xbox One, and now we put on top of it algorithms that are able to understand the sentiment for someone searching, the intent, you know, does the user intend to buy it, or does the user actually just intend to research it and look at it? And then when you model all of that data in a machine learning algorithm that is able to take previous historical actuals for how many number of consoles were sold at a given month, and then you train it on these signals, the model is then ultimately able to project with a very high accuracy what are going to be the sales numbers for my Xbox One platform, or who is going to be eliminated from a given show based on, you know, how people are interacting with that contestant, how they're searching for him, what the sentiment is about him, whether they're visiting his homepage and dwelling there for 20 seconds, or whether they're visiting his homepage and immediately closing the page or going to another contestant. So we'll dive a little bit deeper into some of these examples a little bit later, but we wanted to give you now a few examples of what we've predicted in the past and how we've done it, and I'll turn it over to Walter.
Thanks, Ronnie. So yeah, important question that we had at the beginning is, what can we predict? And the idea is that I think, you know, there's a lot of things that people want answers to questions, and people, very popular ones, you know, and the idea is that we wanted to figure out, given the information we had, what would fit very well. Ronnie kind of gave an example or some descriptions of different things that we can do. But the high-level idea is, initially we looked at things like, you know, I looked into Nobel Prize. And Nobel Prize, predicting Nobel Prize is interesting, but a lot of people don't really follow it throughout the year. People care maybe around the announcement, right? So we had to look at other events. You know, we talked about weather. Weather is something that people care about, but people already know how it's done. There's other scenarios where traditional time series data does very well by itself. So one of the main things is to figure out what kind of scenarios can we do which we can be very highly accurate on, and we can also differentiate with our data and our technology. And one of the examples that made a lot of sense was reality shows. Reality shows, you know, has different shows have a decent number of viewers. The ones that we've been doing, as I'll mention again, is Dancing with the Stars, The Voice, and American Idol. American Idol at one point was very, very popular. I know that the last couple of years waned. They just had their final season this past year. But, you know, a few years back when I started looking at this, I realized that you can actually look at, you know, what people do on the web to get a good signal of who's popular amongst the contestants. And then from that, you can figure out, you know, who will win and who will lose. I'll back up and kind of explain. The show American Idol, since this example I'll start with, you start with 12 finalists. There's an initial period of semifinalists and other things where the judges on the show make a decision. So these contestants have been on TV for a couple of months by the time the live voting show starts. And believe it or not, by the time you get to the final 12, which is where the live TV, live audiences, live voting shows happen, most of America has already judged, created some kind of opinion about each of these 12 contestants. I'd argue that something similar to maybe the elections too, where early on in an election cycle, you may have already made a decision. We don't have the elections until November, but by now, some people may have already decided who they're going to vote for instance, right? And these TV shows, you'll watch American Idol in particular, you know, Ryan Seacrest is a host. He'll tell you, you have to watch every week, listen to the contestants, figure out who you like, and vote each week for who you like. And in an ideal world, you listen to each performance and make this decision each week. But the reality is, you know, people have priors. They find, you know, people who seem to be good contestants or people's voices they like early on, and just vote with them the rest of the show. So what do we do with that? Well, knowing that information, we have this, you know, prior model that, or this assumption, right, hypothesis that people make the decisions early. And by virtue of that, we can look at the web activity for the different contestants. And I think Ronnie kind of mentioned how, you know, we have access to maybe dwell times in certain videos. So how long do you spend on a video page of a contestant? How long do you, I mean, querying a contestant in itself is not sufficient, because what happens is, especially in these reality shows, is sometimes some controversy happens. A contestant is, you know, leaks out some kind of video about their past or some kind of fact about their past, which causes a lot of media attention, and then people will submit searches about them. And that's not really indicative of the popularity for the show, right? Just because if I tell you John Smith has a criminal record, you know, and no one knew about it until today, you might query John Smith just because you're curious, even if you aren't going to be a fan of his songs. But what you do is you look at different things people do. People go to their contestant homepage on American Idol, people go to their YouTube videos, people go to certain public sites and spend a lot of time on them as their fans. And our models use past history, right? So each of these shows has had many years of past results and past outcomes, and we take the training data from that and look at the outcomes, and our models are built from that, right? So then the year before, this is 2 years ago, I guess, we did American Idol, as I mentioned, and the finale, we predicted Caleb Johnson to win. The other two contestants were Jenna Irene and Alex Preston. And what's interesting about this is we actually made a prediction for Caleb to win in early April, which was 6 or 7 weeks before the finale. And the reason why is because the public audience was overwhelmingly in favor of Caleb Johnson. We also have, I haven't mentioned yet, we also have demographic analysis where we can look at where people are voting and what states and what gender and what age groups. And we also learned from past history that this TV show in particular has a heavy younger voting demographic, which is probably not surprising, but also a heavy southern demographic, voting demographic too. And beyond that, we also found that, you know, more women watch it than men. So the idea, I guess, is that young women or young girls will like to vote for the male singers and young men like to vote for the female singers. And there's a heavy block in the South. So if you can figure out effectively, I mean, without, it's not a full thing, but looking at a heavy weight given to female voters in the Deep South, that information would give you a strong signal as to who would win the show. And so if you look at this, if you're not familiar with odds, the numbers are odds against. So if you look at, for instance, Caleb Johnson, top 10 is 4-1. It means that the odds against him winning are 4-1, meaning there's a 1 in 5 chance of him winning, which means they put 20% chance of him winning at the top 10. And one of the things that's interesting is if you look at this is the top five contestants, the people who finished in the top five, the little red tag next to the odds shows you who was favored that week. So if you look from top 13 all the way down, so normally that's the top 12, but that year was 12, 13 contestants. You look all the way down to the finals, you'll notice that Caleb Johnson doesn't have a favorite tag on him anywhere, even in the finale. So most interestingly, we were actually a bit surprised. People who were kind of management in our team were kind of worried about our predictions because the idea was that we were confident. We said, you know, April 1st, the top 8 or top 9, we said Caleb Johnson's going to win this contest. It should be a runaway. But the weird thing was, you know, Vegas odds were showing that not to be the case. So as the show went on, he continued to survive. But the problem was even at the finale, Jenna Irene was 4-7 as a favorite, meaning that she had a 7-11th chance of winning. And even then, you know, people were saying, well, you guys, even though you guys were way out before, or seemingly way out, you guys still have him, but we still think he's not going to win. Well, it turned out Caleb Johnson did win, and people were surprised. And what's interesting, I guess, is that the voting public and people who place wagers in Vegas probably aren't as highly correlated as you expect. People who are, as you mentioned, young women in the Deep South and also young men in the Deep South voting heavily on these shows, those people aren't the people who are placing wagers in Vegas or wherever. So the interesting thing is that our web data and our social data has turned out to have stronger information about these contestants than kind of the markets, which some people believe, if you're familiar with kind of market efficiency hypotheses, you think that if you have enough liquidity in a trading market or a gambling market, you would have the best odds there. But in a show like American Idol, we found otherwise. And one of the interesting things is that we were able to get a lot of bang for the buck, if you will, in these predictions. And we've continued to do this. I mean, we did The Voice, and then we did Dancing with the Stars, and our accuracy is over 90%. You know, if you want to know statistically and mathematically, if you're talking about random numbers, with 12 contestants left, you have a 1 in 12 chance of picking who's going to be eliminated, right? And so our accuracies aren't just picking the winner, but also picking who's going to be eliminated each week. And we have a 90% accuracy rate on that. And you know, randomly, you have like an 8.3% chance at top 12, 10% at top 10, 12.5% at top 8. And so you can see that if you randomly pick, it'd be very difficult. But the information we have on the web is so valuable, so highly correlated that our models are pretty much tuned to figure out who's going to win and who's going to be eliminated each week. But that's the reality shows. I'll pass to Ronnie and talk about some of the sports and some of the other experiences we have.
Yeah, thanks, Walter. So as Walter, you know, mentioned, for reality shows, you can kind of imagine why the signals that we have are pretty well correlated with someone being eliminated or someone staying on the show, right? If you like Caleb Johnson, as Walter mentioned, you're likely to, listen to his music on YouTube, visit his homepage, even go click on that vote button. You're likely to tweet positively about him and just kind of interact overall positive with him on the web. Now, in the world of sports, you know, you can start to think, how can that data really determine who's going to win the next match? And if we were to take the World Cup, Brazil or Germany, because ultimately, it's really the player's performance on the field that determines whether Brazil is going to outscore Germany or Germany is going to outscore. But we essentially had a hypothesis that if we were able to capture the wisdom of the crowd, we would actually enhance statistical models. So what we did is we started out with a base statistical model. Your statistical model considers things such as margins of victory, who, you know, how many times did Brazil win versus Germany when they played on Germany's home field, and vice versa. And it considers different statistics about the teams, the players, to basically, you know, project a probability for who is likely to win, Brazil or Germany, in the next match. But this is where our data comes in as an additional signal to, you know, push us over in terms of accuracy. So what we do is we try to look over the web and we try to capture what Brazil fans and what Germany fans think about the match. So what we do is we look for people who are Brazil fans. These are people who are, you know, follow Brazil, they tweet about them, they follow the players, they live and breathe Brazil, right? They know every statistic there is to know, every previous game, they watch these games on television. We know that by them searching for it online, right, searching for schedules, results, scores, things like that. And we find that same equivalent group for Germany. Then what we do is we analyze what the sentiment is for these, you know, Brazil fans and Germany fans towards the match, right? So for that match, we saw, for example, that Germany fans are predicting and they really think that their team is going to win the match, whereas Brazil fans were kind of doubtful about their team winning the next match, right? Because, you know, the things we capture as well is the fact that Neymar was injured, Brazil's captain also wasn't playing because I think of a double yellow card, so he wasn't playing in the next match. And so because of that negative sentiment that we were able to capture that essentially Brazil has a lower chance of winning because of these three things, right? Neymar is injured, their captain is out, and then three, the fact that their fans really have a negative sentiment about them winning. When you model these signals into your machine-trained model, in addition to the statistical model, then you achieve a higher accuracy, and it's why we were able to say that Germany is going to win the match versus Brazil, whereas most other experts out there were predicting Brazil to win because, you know, they had the home field advantage, and statistically speaking, Brazil was stronger than Germany on when they had the home field advantage. And so this is how we were able to predict the Germany win over Brazil, and then ultimately for the World Cup, we were about 94%, I think it was 94% accurate for the knockout rounds. And how we're currently, you know, predicting sports like NFL, March Madness. We're predicting top national leagues, including the Champions League. And then soon we'll also be doing predictions for the Euro 2016. So you can look forward to that as well.
And for soccer, I'll just mention, Ronnie said, we're 94%, which was 15-1. We actually got all 15 knockout round games right, and then we missed the consolation round game. And as you can probably have an idea, the effort level or predictivity of kind of consolation games is a little bit more difficult. But, you know, either 15-0 for the elimination games or 15-1 all up, I think we're pretty happy with the ability, with the fact that using the web and social data and adding the wisdom of the crowds technology on top of the traditional models actually gave us that opportunity to get that accuracy. Oh, okay. So then the next event I want to talk about that we did was the Scotland referendum. So in 2014, we had focused mostly on events in the U.S., except for the World Cup, right? But in terms of in the fall, we wanted to move our focus to Europe and kind of introduce Bing Predicts to Europe. And so the Scotland referendum was a good example because people were interested in knowing whether or not the country of Scotland wanted to become independent from the United Kingdom. And we did this analysis, as Ronnie had mentioned earlier, that, you know, we talked about sentiment and intent. And the idea is that, you know, looking at reality shows, for instance, you don't really have to worry about that. Most people, there aren't people who are negative on these contestants. Either you're following a contestant because you like them or you don't. It's not like you intentionally want to be negative against a contestant and you want to kind of spread negative will or whatever. But when it comes to politics, as you know, there's the idea that every person's interest can be positive and negative. You could be researching independence, but you could be against it, right? So what we had to do is we built, you know, both the classifiers as well as kind of sentiment analyzers on top of that, looking at social signals, looking at web signals, and seeing what do people think about this idea of Scotland independence. And more importantly, we actually wanted to focus on people who are eligible voters. And the reason why is during the event, the rest of the United Kingdom thought it was a good idea to keep Scotland as a country. But the voters who are eligible are people in Scotland who may have had a different opinion. So we were able to kind of filter down and look at data which is focused specifically for Scotland, and we found that the vote was close. In fact, from July 1st to about September 18th, which is when the actual vote happened, we found that the vote was, the opinion was slightly to the no, meaning that between 51 to 59% of the time, people were saying that Scotland should not leave the Union. And we were at 53% the night of the event. The final vote was 55%. So we were pretty close. You know, the mean of our range also happened to be 55%. But what's more interesting, though, is that the polls that were out there had a much wider range. We saw numbers as low as 40% no, meaning yes, right, or 70% no. And when we first came up with a prediction in early July, the markets were saying like 70, 75% no. And people were saying, oh, there's no way this election will be a yes. But what we found out was that, you know, our numbers were more accurate because people were actually doing what they thought they, you know, voicing their opinion or actions didn't belie their opinions, right? And the idea is that if you look at polling, they did some research afterwards, not for us, but just a general study for the folks in London. They found out that the polls were biased, and the idea was that it seemed like a lot of the pollsters are from London, and some of them are going into Scotland and asking questions. The exact questions weren't known, but you can imagine if you are a resident of Scotland, you have the vote ability to vote for this, and you have someone from the capital, right, London, coming over and asking if you want to leave the country or leave the Union. You may think that there's a certain answer people are expecting, right? And even if only 10% of people ask are afraid to answer correctly, you suddenly have this bias, right? Especially if all of them are biased towards saying, well, the person asking me the question wants me to say no, so I'll say no. You know, even if 90% of the opinions are honest and 10% are biased toward no, you have a very biased sample, right? And the idea is that if you look on the web, what people do on the web, you know, I emphasize all the stuff we do is anonymized and in aggregate. So, you know, Microsoft, we care very much about privacy, so we don't violate that. But the point is, what people do on the web, even if it's, you know, anonymized, if we have access to that information, we know that they're doing what they care about, right? As we mentioned earlier, for reality shows, it's pretty easy. If I'm a fan of Caleb Johnson and not Alex Preston, I'll spend, like, a lot of time listening to Caleb Johnson videos and not Alex Preston's. I'm not going to just listen to his videos just to throw someone off, right? That's not the intent of anybody. So, similarly, you know, what people see on social media and what people search for, type of pages they visit, kind of gives you an opinion, gives us a breakdown of people's opinions of which way they're going to vote. And by virtue of that, we were able to do a pretty good job with this event. So that was Scotland referendum. I'll go on and talk about the different areas that we've done, right? So I mentioned already that, you know, we've proven ourselves, and I'll describe how, for those who are not familiar with us, you know, by using the comprehensive web and social data to be kind of the expert in each field. The reality shows I mentioned earlier, excess of 90% is our accuracy. We did the 2014 midterms in America. We were 97% in the Senate, 96% in the House. We did other reality shows. I mentioned Dancing with the Stars is a good example. We've had 95% accuracy there. You know, similar to the Caleb Johnson story from American Idol, we have a nice fun story about Dancing with the Stars, which is a couple of seasons ago, our signal was super strong on Rumor Willis. She's a child of Bruce Willis and Demi Moore. And she was expected to win. I don't know if you can see from the screen, the tweet we sent out was on April 21st. The finale was a month later. But basically, our models are so confident, we said, you know, we should just tweet out and let people know this is who we're picking, right? And the funny story is you see people's comments after we tweeted that saying, well, Rumor Willis is not a favorite. There's no way she's going to win. You know, and a month later, she wins the contest. So, again, this is one of those situations where I think the general public, maybe the internet public, might think that certain people are the best. But if you look at kind of an aggregate of people are doing on the web, you can see that we can have insights in terms of who will win and who won't win. From reality shows, we move to award shows. Award shows are a little bit different. Award shows are done by a handful of select people, experts, if you will, the academy. You know, so we basically, what we want to do there is to build a model to figure out how the academy will vote. Much the same way if you look at kind of MVP voting for sporting professional sports or Heisman Trophy voting. A select group of people vote, and sometimes their votes are different from the general public. And the idea is we build models learned on prior results on prior years to figure out who are the most important voters. For instance, the academy, the age distribution of academy voters is older versus younger. So it may be that when we look at our models and figure out what people are doing, we give the people who are older a heavier weight because they're more representative of the voters in the academy. We've got 84% accurate there. World Cup, Ronnie had already mentioned this. You know, the 2014 World Cup, we're 94%. And then we ventured into NFL. And the first year we did it, which was the 2004 NFL season, we predicted a Super Bowl winner around Thanksgiving. We predicted the Patriots, so that year the Seahawks were the opponent eventually in the Super Bowl, so the locals really weren't happy with us. But, you know, the message we get people is that our models, our machines don't have any local biases. We like the teams locally. We have preferences for the Seahawks, but the machine doesn't, and the machine got it right. Last year we did the entire regular season, and we were in the top 10% amongst experts, so we predicted the winners of every game and ended up in the top 10%. I'm showing you this next slide. For those of you not familiar with kind of our work, you know, we've had some good press on this. The top left one is a story about the World Cup, which Ronnie mentioned earlier, that we're 94%, 15-0 in the knockout rounds. We got a lot of good publicity there. The top right question one is an interesting one. We'll talk more about in a minute in the enterprise space, is that we actually did some early analysis of how we can use our data to help save lives, help people in the enterprise space. And one area which we ended up publishing a nice paper on is looking at adverse drug reactions from search log data. Let me give you some intuition behind that. The idea is that if you're a pharmaceutical drug maker, you make a drug and you're required to go through these drug trials. And during these drug trials, the intent is to figure out all possible potential issues with it. But the difficulty with it is, you know, I think that every company does their best and they try to find everything, and the regulations do their best to control that. But the reality is there are a lot of drugs out there, and very few people, there's some drugs that people take two of, right, two different drugs, and very few people do the same thing. So those people might not be in the same in the drug trial. So then a drug gets released, and then people determine these adverse drug reactions. And the idea is that, as you probably know, if you guys are comfortable using the web now, before you go see a doctor, before you go to your mechanic, before you go, I don't know, to call tech support, you often will do a search on the web, right? You want to say, oh, am I the only person experiencing this, or are 100,000 people experiencing this? Well, the same thing happens for drugs, right? Before you call your doctor, if you're taking drug A and drug B and you have a headache, you might submit a search that says drug A, drug B, headache. And the idea is that, again, in an anonymized and aggregate form, we can see that if we see a handful of people submitting these queries, and even having a similar session, you submit headache in the morning, 6 hours later, same query from the same anonymized user says drug A, drug B, nausea, you know, and 3 hours later, drug A, drug B, vomiting. We may suspect, you know, we obviously don't know for a fact, but the idea is it's an inference problem where we say there may be an adverse drug reaction between drug A and drug B. It looks like 12 people in America in the past year or whatever, or X people have been doing this. So we can report this to the FDA or to anyone else that is interested in knowing, hey, maybe there should be some kind of analysis or deeper dive on this. And hopefully the information can save lives, at a minimum inform the public and let people know, let doctors know, hey, if a person is on drug A and you're going to prescribe drug B, do know there may be adverse drug reactions. So that was kind of one of the things we did. The bottom right is an interesting story is that we did March Madness, which is the annual college basketball tournament. The tournament is difficult to do because it's called Madness because there's a lot of uncertainty. But we published a bracket, which is kind of like the maximum likelihood type of scenario, right? And then our CEO, Satya Nadella, what used our information as a guide and made his picks. And he was able to pick, if you guys remember the year before, he picked, this is before the tournament started, he picked Wisconsin to beat Arizona, which was a minor upset. There was an upset in that regard. Then again, using that information, what we had a model said that the team that Kentucky could lose to most likely was Wisconsin. His bracket picked Wisconsin over Kentucky, which was a major, major upset. And then he picked Duke over Wisconsin in the finals. So that bracket was in the top 0.7% or something of all brackets nationwide. And so, you know, basically using our machine learning models and taking a look at our upset type scenario, he was able to kind of get a great, great bracket. And the idea, the main question people ask is, how come our bracket didn't do it? The idea is, the analogy I'll give you is, imagine if you have two loaded coins. I'd say one coin has a 99% chance of flipping heads, the other one has a 51% chance of being heads. If I flip them both, what would you predict? In both cases, you still say heads. So the best likely scenario is we still pick, you know, the 51%. But the idea is that we give those numbers and say, look, if you want to pick an upset, this is the upset to pick, you know, the Wisconsin or Kentucky upset. And that worked out pretty well because Kentucky was undefeated, and this is a year ago, not this season, the prior season, and people were very high on them. So, you know, our models had thought that it didn't match up well with Wisconsin. And we also had them pick, you know, our models show that Wisconsin could beat Arizona. So that was quite a nice opportunity for our CEO to kind of do a good job on the bracket. Bottom left corner is just a great story from Tech Insider, which is an independent party source that looked at our work throughout the NFL season and created a good story about how we do a good job predicting games. So, you know, I just share this because, you know, the work we've done, you know, for those of you not familiar, is that we've done a lot of work, but, you know, with any prediction or any model, you know, it takes time to kind of establish credibility. And over time, I think we slowly developed it through different categories. Now, for this, now that we've built credibility, I think we want to talk a little bit in the last like 15 minutes about possibilities we can apply this to enterprise. Ronnie?
Yep, thanks, Walter. Yep, so as Walter just briefly started talking about, one of the things that we started experimenting with is how can we take that technology on top of the data set that we have and, you know, apply our machine learning algorithms and our topic modeling, intent analysis, sentiment analysis on top of this data that we have in order to help a business or a company drive better business decisions through this data. And so for a few different scenarios, which you can see listed here, what we wanted to do is essentially build a machine-trained model that is able to help a company drive better business insights in all these different areas, from sales and marketing to finance and risk, customer and operations and workforce. So what we're going to be doing for the next 15 to 20 minutes is dive a little bit deeper into each of these verticals, tell you a little bit about what are the models that we've built in these areas, and how have we applied them internally to our own company, Microsoft? How did we improve a business insight or a business decision here that essentially helped improve an internal product for us at Microsoft, and how that theoretically could be extended and applied to, you know, external companies across different industries? So I'll start with sales, our forecast, sales and marketing. So the idea behind sales and marketing is that really we have the data that helps us capture users' browsing behavior, users' click behavior, as well as the internet, and it helps us capture the why behind the buy, and as well as capture the demand online for a given entity, whether that entity is a product, whether it's a person, or whether it's a company. And so we have built models across sales and marketing. One of the models that we have built is a demand forecasting model or a sales forecasting model. So what the model does is, given historical actuals for sales numbers, it is able to essentially project what are going to be the sales numbers for that entity in the next upcoming period, whether that period is a quarter or whether that period is a month. And what we did is we essentially applied it internally to our Xbox One platform, and we were able to achieve a 50% reduction in error rate in terms of basically getting it closer to what the actual numbers are. So let me dive into this a little bit more. So what you see on the screen on the left-hand side is essentially the data sources that we look at, which we've been talking about, right? One is essentially Bing, and this is the search engine that Microsoft has. And so it's what people click on, what they search for, and how long they stay on the page. The second data source we have access to is our Internet Explorer or Edge, so our browsers. And so whatever people type within their browser, assuming they have opted in, we have access to that data, and so we're able to see what they're searching for on that page. And ultimately, and one of our richest data sources as well, is the internet, right? Any public document you can think about, anything that you can type within your browser, and you can see, so it is a public document, we crawl, index, and are able to parse and extract the content of that page. So whether it's extracting the tweet that someone did, or whether it's extracting the number of subscribers or number of likes on a YouTube video, if it's a public page, we are able to parse that content out and get that data. So on top of it, what you see there, which is the second column, is we have a set of technologies and that helps us understand the data, right, make sense of the data. So these are things like disambiguation algorithms, being able to differentiate between someone searching for Windows, the operating system, and, you know, Windows referring to his windshield. We have intent algorithms, so algorithms that help us determine whether the search for Xbox was a research intent or was a buy intent, or was it a news intent, right? We have sentiment algorithms, algorithms that help you determine whether someone is talking about the Xbox platform in a positive way or a negative way. We have topic modeling algorithms, so these are algorithms that take large pieces of text and are able to extract the topic. You know, what are people talking about in this paragraph? What is the entity that they're referring to? So when you take all of this technology and then apply it on top of the data, which you see in the third column, as I mentioned, right, searches, what people type within their browser, tweets, things like that, then you're able to come up with what we call features. So features are things like, you know, the number of times people search for Xbox over the past month, the number of times people positively mentioned Xbox over the past 2 days, the number of times people searched for Xbox accessories on Amazon.com. The number of times people did product comparisons between Xbox and PlayStation. Now, what you do is when you take all of that data, you come up with a very rich set of features that, you know, one or more of these features are going to help project what the sales numbers for Xbox are going to be, but we don't know what these features are, and this is where machine learning comes into play. So if I switch over to the next slide, now what you see here, the idea is what you see on the left column is what Xbox did previous to Bing Predicts coming in, is they would look at their previous historical sales numbers, and by doing some time series analysis, looking at their historical sales numbers, they essentially project what are going to be my sales numbers for the next quarter. Now, on the right-hand side is where Bing Predicts comes into the picture. So we take the signals provided by the time series analysis that the Xbox team did, but what we add to it is we add to it the features that I just showed, right? We add to it things like how many times did people search for Xbox, how many times did people look at Xbox reviews, what's the sentiment around Xbox, how many times did people compare it to PlayStation. You know, someone searching for Xbox accessories is a good indication that they have an Xbox. And what we do then is we run a machine learning algorithm that looks at the historical sales numbers and looks at all of these data features and then trains and learns what are the data feature values that help project and what is the projected label, in the label in this case being the Xbox sales numbers. And then when we apply it on the next quarterly results, we are able to actually project the Xbox sales numbers with a 50% reduction in error. So it, the way to think about it, we are essentially 50% closer to truth, where the truth is the actual sales numbers as they were released. And so by doing this, we were able to essentially prove that our technology can be applied to estimate the demand or the sales forecasting report for a product and an entity, and theoretically this could be extended to other entities as well, right? Whether it's the entity is a company, whether the entity is an auto model or, you know, a car model or a car make, as Walter will just talk to in a second, that technology could theoretically be applied to whatever the entity may be.
Thanks, Ronnie. So I just wanted to summarize step one, step up this, so you guys get, make sure you get the context. The idea what Ronnie just explained is that, you know, we're looking for categories or areas in enterprise where we could differentiate, right? And the differentiation, as Ronnie said two slides ago, is that we have unique data that no one else has access to, and we also have unique understanding of the data. And the example Ronnie was giving about, I think, Windows, you know, an example of Surface is also true. I mean, if you think about these products, we have a lot of these products that have these names that have consumer-based value, you know, Windows versus, you know, the Windows operating system versus Windows on the outside, you know, to look outside, and Surface versus Surface tables or whatever. And the idea is very similar to what we do with elections, reality shows, is we're actually looking at what people do, consumer products in particular, like Xbox is a consumer product. So what people do on publicly searching for information that can help us determine their interest. And one example I'll also show right here is auto sales. So we, you know, we mentioned that the enterprise work is kind of in incubation, and we're kind of exploring with some companies. And some of the early work we looked at was beyond Xbox, looking at, hey, look at auto cars. People, we found research, you know, on the web. People do research on the web for cars. You want to buy a car, very few people just go out tomorrow and buy a car. I assume that it's a big enough purchase for most of us that we need a couple months or something to look at it, right? So we can learn kind of behaviors on the web that translate to buying. And so we did the same thing where we predicted the accuracy per make. And we worked with a customer, which I've anonymized the data here just as a, since it's a private test. But the idea is that we were more accurate than this leading expert, especially in cars which had less sales. And the idea is that I think automakers, which are very well established, have a pretty good understanding of how much they'll sell. But newer or smaller makes, more niche makes, or even ones that which don't have as much volume, there's a little more uncertainty. But looking at the web, we can actually see what people are doing. You know, we could tell you how many of a certain luxury model car will be sold in, let's say, Montana, which is kind of a, you know, a difficult thing for someone to do if they're not familiar with kind of the demand in Montana without having to send somebody out there to do some kind of polling and understanding. So this model shows you that you can sort of see from left to right, the left side, the original customer data or state-of-the-art traditional time series does a good job, I guess, maybe a little bit better in some cases. But as you move to the right part of this chart, you can see that we do a much, much better job predicting accuracies. If you look at, like, say, the one that's ninth farthest on the right, we're over 90% accurate, whereas the state-of-the-art before was we're over 95% accurate, whereas the state-of-the-art was in the 80% accurate range. So you can sort of see that we have a lot of good optics, and we're able to kind of apply it there. We also look in different areas, right? One area is finance and risk. And the idea is that looking at information like what people do on the web, you can figure out some simple things like how's the economy, right? So what people do, what people's economic situations affect how they, what they do on the web, how they search. We look at things like unemployment, and we talked about auto sales already. Housing demand is probably something you could believe, right? If you're buying a house, it's a bigger purchase than a car, so you don't just go out tomorrow and buy a house, right? You spend some time looking, you do certain things, you need to get pre-approved for a loan, you need to kind of see how much you can afford, figure out, make assets available for down payment, or all these different things. So the housing demand is also something we can actually see well from consumer, right? And all of these things are very important for kind of the macroeconomic state of the country. And so therefore, you know, we have a lot of good optics in this, and we have a lot of good opportunities to kind of do a good job predicting this area.
Great. Thanks, Walter. And yeah, one of the other verticals that we showed as well was around customer and channel. So, you know, being, again, as, you know, indexing the web and understanding what people search for, one of the things that we are able to do as well is we are able to essentially understand users' profile, user characteristics, and what they search for and co-search for together. So, you know, just to give you some random example, as an OpenTable user, you're likely to, you know, be tech savvy, you're likely to own an iPhone, be an app user, and as well at the same time, dine out a lot, right? Search for restaurants and wanting to dine out a lot. And so the idea is behind what we do is we are able to capture a customer profile or customer characteristics and capture this, you know, why behind the buy, as well as being able to capture what people co-search for together. And so because we are able to do this, one of the things that we are able to do is essentially come up with product recommendations. And so one of the case studies that we did is we've worked with our PowerPoint team, so our office team, to try and understand what are people saying about the PowerPoint software and what are some of the problems that they are having with it. And so the idea is we went online and we started looking at what when people are searching for PowerPoint, what else are they searching for, what is the sentiment about it, and is there any keywords that are coming up more prominently than others? And we found out that, you know, through our analysis, there's a lot of features that came up for what people are looking for and what are the biggest troubles that they're having with PowerPoint when we focused our search on negative sentiment. And when we did that, we were able to come back to the PowerPoint team and give them a prioritized list of features based on users. And so by doing that, we were able to essentially tell the PowerPoint team what are the features that they should focus on in order to make their users more happy.
So as I wind down the last couple of slides, I will say that we've left up some time at the end for questions. So if you have questions, please do voice them in the Q&A, and we'll answer them both individually as well as, you know, we'll answer the ones that are kind of public interest to everybody too. So one other area which we do well on is operations and workforce. And the idea behind this is basically optimization, lead generation. One of the ways we look at it is how do we know, you know, in the CRM space, how do you know which customers to kind of work with and which ones are ones that will resonate well with you? With our data, web data, we can actually get a better idea of what these companies are. Imagine if you're, let's say, a plumbing company, a plumbing supplier, and you have a bunch of companies. You have John's Supply Shop. And you don't really know anything about that company. Like, is that something that they would need us or not? Or if you're an IT company, if you realize that the John Supply Shop from our web data is it's an IT shop, you might realize people who sell software might go talk to them. But if you realize John's Supply Shop is a supply shop for, I don't know, hardware or like a Home Depot type store, then you know, plumbing company may have more services for them, right? So the idea is that we look at different ways to improve operations. We actually have done some internal tests also for outages, where we worked with our office team to figure out if there's an outage in a service like Exchange, can we help you find it before it's escalated to whatever tier 3 or tier 4 top levels and analyze? And the idea is that people, similar to the example I told earlier about health, and you know, before you go see a doctor, you might do a search. Before you call tech support, if you can't access Hotmail or if you can't access something on Exchange, you may want to check online to see if there's an issue, right? Or if you have a phone, right, and your phone has kind of weird behavior, it won't sync, you will search, I have, you know, Windows Phone 7, does it still sync with blah, right, Hotmail, whatever, and you can sort of find issues quickly there. So we've actually been able to find get good optics on that. We've also been able to look at brand perception and a brand correlation, meaning that let's say you're a provider and you have one product, let's say Surface. Maybe a Surface Book correlates very highly with Lumia 920. You know, we can actually do the work and figure out, give you analysis and figure out what is the correlation between two entities? What's the highest adherence between two different things? And this is valuable because if you're marketing one, you might as well market the other, right? You wouldn't market, let's say, you're marketing Lumia, the Lumia series and marketing server, you know, Microsoft Windows Server. People who buy server are generally kind of IT professionals and not necessarily people who buy consumer phones. So you want to make sure you're marketing to the right people if you kind of bundle kind of marketing campaigns. So we have the capability of looking at web data to do something similar. So that's kind of one thing to do. In summary, I'll summarize before we take questions. Or okay, you, please ask questions at the same time. But in summary, the example is a Windows 10. You know, we analyzed Windows 10 before launch. There was a question of, you know, what people's sentiment and understanding was before when we announced it, before it was released, and we got a lot of good optics for our marketing team. So to summarize, I guess I'll just say what we talked about is we kind of introduced how Bing Critics came to be, right? The project came because we've been in Bing Search for a long time and looking at search information correlates well to kind of predicting future events. What we're doing is we're using this data, which is unique to Microsoft, and the technology, which we've got years of experience on as running a search engine, to make inferences beyond the traditional predictive analytics. So we also take the predictive analytics data. So for instance, if we're doing Xbox sales, we're not going to just do Xbox sales predictions based off of public information. We also take a look at the sales data, which the traditional data scientists do, right? Because we don't want to leave any information on the table. Much like what Ronnie was talking about with soccer, we're not going to predict who's going to win the World Cup based off popularity, right? I mean, you look at the largest countries in the world, one being the most popular possibly, and therefore we predict them to win. You know, predicting the United States to win the World Cup in soccer wouldn't be the best thing to do, you know, if you look at 2014, for instance, right? So the idea is that we actually look at all the data other people have, right, which is statistical models for sports, and we add the web and social data on top of that to get better accuracies. And as I mentioned earlier, showed earlier in the automotive example, we're getting a lift, you know, a several percent using this additional information. And that's kind of why we're very positive or ambitious about using this in terms of many enterprise scenarios. With that, I think we'll close and answer any questions. Anything that we should on the nothing?
No
questions.
So I'll add to what Walter mentioned. I mean, what we're trying to do is, you know, use our data and use our algorithms to try and help predict the future. One aspect of it is our consumer product, which is kind of in entertainment, sports, and politics, which is we show on Bing.com. And if you go to Bing.com and search for a lot of events that are live today in sports, entertainment, and politics, you'll be able to see our predictions. So if you go to Bing and search for The Voice, Dancing with the Stars, NASCAR, NBA playoffs, and you'll be able to see our predictions there and see which teams are we picking to win, and in some instances, why are we picking one team to win versus the other. You can read some of our external blogs as well as kind of articles, press articles about how we do our predictions for our consumer product. And at the same time, as Walter mentioned and we talked about previously, one of the things that we started doing is essentially using those same algorithms and that same data in order to be able to help solve different enterprise questions. We have applied it internally to our Microsoft team, and we have showed that with different product teams ranging across our Windows operating system, our Office software, to our Xbox and Surface platforms, that we were able to project and improve different and solve different business problems. And we're starting to experiment and see, you know, how can we extend this, right? As you saw in the auto sales forecasting model, how are we able to essentially take the data and algorithms that we have, and for example, be able to predict whether a new car model is going to hit its target return or how much, you know, how many units are you going to sell. Now imagine if you go to a car manufacturer and you offer them this formula that achieves, you know, X percent accuracy improvement or X percent error rate reduction, and you're able to tell them, here's how many units I think you're going to sell out of a new car model that you're just about to release. You can imagine how much that information would be valuable to that auto manufacturer, because he's able to essentially optimize his production better in order not to overproduce or underproduce. So, you know, an example, when Volvo released their XC90, they essentially underestimated the demand. And so they were sold out on the very first weekend. And because of that, they had to rush production. Now, imagine if we were to use our algorithm by analyzing, again, the web, the fact that there is interest about it, positive sentiment, people are looking for it, and also understanding market trends, right? There's a huge shift in people wanting SUVs, let's say, right? Or people wanting a certain type of cars, a certain type of features in cars, right? And by doing this, we understand that the demand for the XC90 is going to be this many units, and it's much closer to truth than what Volvo would be able to project. And by doing that, we would save them, you know, millions and millions of dollars. And that's just one of the many business problems that we can do. And with that, we'll close, and I'll turn it over to you guys if you have any questions, or Rahi can close.
Hi, thanks Ronnie and Walter for the great presentation. As a reminder, we'll be sending out the slides and the recording of the session within 24 hours. And if you can take a moment to leave some feedback on the poll, we really appreciate the feedback as it helps us to make our webinars more effective. I'll leave this open for a few minutes. Hopefully you guys have had some time to enter your feedback. Thank you everyone for joining us, and have a great day.